Blog Talk Radio.
This is Off the Chain, and I am your host, Yvonne Mason. That was Indistinguishable Magic by Dan L. Hollyfield. And there is a story behind this music, and it is absolutely magnificent. I hope Dan is listening because I see things when I hear his music. Tonight's guest, and before I start with tonight's guest, let me just quickly say that because this show is off the chain, anything and everything usually does happen, but I'm always looking for guests. I don't care if you're an author, an artist, a musician, an activist, a business person, you have a platform, you have a passion. That's what this show is about. So contact me. Get yourself on the show. Get yourself out there. I promise, I won't eat you alive. I might bite you a little bit, but it won't hurt much. That being said, I want to introduce you to tonight's guest, author and, yes, ladies and gentlemen, rocket scientist, Miss Stephanie Osborne.
Hi, Yvonne.
Hey, sweetheart. few can claim the varied background of Stephanie Osborne, the interstellar woman of mystery. She is a veteran of more than 40 years in the civilian space program, as well as various military space defense programs. She worked on numerous space shuttle flights in the International Space Station and counts the training of astronauts on her resume. Her space experience also includes space lab and ISS operations, variable star astrophysics, Martian Eolian geophysics, radiation physics, and nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons effects. That's just the beginning, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, girls, ladies, young ladies, little girls, you can grow up to be a rocket scientist. She holds graduate and undergraduate degrees in four sciences, astronomy, physics, chemistry, and mathematics. And she is fluent in several more, including geology and anatomy. That's just the beginning. In addition, Stephanie possesses a license of ministry. She has been a duly sworn certified police officer and is a National Weather Service certified storm spotter. Yes, girls, you can do all that. Her travels have included taking her to the top of Pikes Peak, across the world's highest suspension bridge, down gold mines, in the footsteps of dinosaurs, through groves of giant sequoias, and even to the volcanoes of the Cascade Range in the Pacific Northwest, where she was present for several eruptions of Mount St. Helens. Well, she decided that she needed to retire, so Stephanie trained her sights on writing. She has authored or co-authored or contributed to more than 20 books, including the celebrated science fiction mystery Burnout, The Mystery of Space Shuttle STS-281. She co-authored the Crisperian Saga, I hope I said that right, book series, and currently writes the critically acclaimed Displaced Detective series, described as Sherlock Holmes meets the X-Files. She recently released her paranormal and horror novella, El Vengador, based on a true story, and it is in an e-book. I'm tired reading this. In addition to her writing work, the interstellar woman of mystery now is happily paying it forward. She teaches math and science through numerous medias, including radio, podcasting, and public speaking, as well as working with Sigma, the science fiction think tank. Hello, Steph. Again, I am tired now. What a wonderful, wonderful resume.
Well, thank you. I was sitting here just stifling the giggles, so I don't think about it until somebody reads it. And then I'm like, oh, crap, I have done a lot.
Yes, you have, honey. Yes, you have. You certainly have. You know, you and I have been around with each other since that first book, Burnout, came out, which seems so long ago.
Well, it came out in April of 2009. So, yeah, about 7 years, over 7 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But it seems like yesterday. Because I remember when the book came out, and I got it, and I read it, and I couldn't put it down.
Well, that's always a good sign.
Yep. And of course, your career, just what made you become a rocket scientist?
Oh, geez. Well, I'm older than most people think I am, although I think it's starting to catch up with me. But I remember when I was very, very small, two things caught my attention, diametrically opposed in a way, but yet not. One was that as a very small child, I discovered this TV series called Star Trek.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool if we could really do that? And the other thing that caught my attention was the Apollo 1 fire. Yes, I am old enough to, I do remember it. It's kind of early on. My memories are fuzzy, but I do remember it. And I began to realize that these are the guys that are working to try to make this TV show real. And then it kind of hit me in my little kid brain that these guys just died trying to make the TV show real. That's how much it meant to them. And that impressed me as a little kid. That the level that hit me is just, I can't even describe it, but I said, you know what? I want to help make that real too.
Wow.
And my entire education from elementary school all the way through graduate school, I became fixated on what courses do I need to take, what do I need to study to help make me better, to help make me more knowledgeable, to help me do this. And that's why I've got all those different degrees. It wasn't something that I set out to do. It was simply a case of, well, if I take these courses over here, that'll help me do this later. Well, okay, now I've taken all these courses. Well, heck, if I take two more courses, I can major in the thing or minor or whatever. And so I did. And that's how I got all of that stuff in that resume.
Well, let me ask you this. When you broke into the field as a rocket scientist, when you were actually in that field, was it hard as a female to be accepted and respected in that field, which is for many, many years been male dominated?
Yes and no. I ran into a few people that had some attitudes, but by the time that I actually got into it, there were starting to be more and more women doing these sorts of things. So, yes, I encountered some guys that gave me some problems. I encountered a couple of women that gave me problems. But in the main, not the problems that I had, I don't think so much had to do with my gender as much as it was the fact that people looked at my resume and reacted the way you just did. It was like, oh, my gosh, you know, who is this person? And evidently I intimidated people without ever meaning to.
Well, so I think it's a wonderful – I admire it. I respect it because people that don't go to college and don't further their education, not because they're not capable, and I don't mean that smart-wise, but some people just going to college is not their thing. They want to go to a technical school, which I admire as well because that's big and important.
Oh, absolutely.
But to put that much time, effort, passion and investment into what it took to become a rocket scientist, because people don't understand that that's not just a word. You literally hold someone's life in your hands when they go up in the air into outer space.
Yes. And it's amazing that you brought that up, because I was talking with an old colleague who has since retired, but he and I worked numerous shuttle missions together, a guy by the name of Larry Bauer. He lives here in Huntsville, and he and I have stayed friends over the years, and we were talking about that just the other day. It's like people do not understand, you know, when you say you sat console for a shuttle mission. Oh, well, yeah, you showed up to work and you sat at the computer and you did this and that. But they don't really fully realize, yeah, and if we screwed up, somebody upstairs died.
Yeah, if you were off 1 second or 1/1000th of a degree in your longitude, latitude, or 1 millimeter of your oxygen intake or your carbon dioxide outtake or whatever it is, those people might not make it home.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it's he and I have actually decided we're going to write a series of blog articles talking about some of the missions that we work and some of the things that we worked that were of the more dangerous sorts. Like I can remember, and he bless him, he was able to come up. I couldn't remember what satellite it was, but it was the long duration something or other facility. It was LDEF was the acronym, and it had been up there for some years. It was actually up there, was placed up there before the Challenger disaster, and I was. He and I were working the program after the return to flight from the Challenger disaster, and so LDEF it was designed to be taken up, left in orbit for a period of time, and then brought back so that the experiments on board could be analyzed. Well, it had been up there way longer than it was supposed to be, and if they didn't go get it, it was going to fall out of the sky.
Uh-huh.
So one of the missions that I worked was one of their goals was to fetch LDEF and bring it back home. But the problem was it had been up there so long, they were having a hard time grappling it with the remote manipulator arm. And they wound up actually having to send astronauts out into the payload bay to manually grapple the thing and pull it down into the bay. And you don't really stop and think about you're manipulating a multi-ton satellite with, like, three people, maybe?
And at any given time, it could take on a life of its own and pull them out into the netherworld.
Or catch them up between it and one of the walls of the payload bay. Or it had sharp edges on it. Maybe they grabbed it in the wrong place and sliced open a gauntlet. Now you've got a suit breach and you're losing your atmosphere into space. You know, there were any number of ways that could have gone very, very badly, but it didn't. Nothing went wrong. Everything went fine. They got it down into the payload bay and they brought it home. And that's what's called teamwork.
Exactly.
That was us on the ground in Huntsville, in Houston, the guys upstairs on orbit. You know, all of us working together to get the satellite and our crew members back home safe.
And so, people don't realize that it takes everyone to always be alert and on point and almost reading each other's minds to work as one unit.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And you people... If you weren't there to experience it, you're not aware of it, and it's really not it's not something that the public affairs office is necessarily responsible for or not responsible for. It's just one of those things. If you're doing your job, then everything works right, and everybody comes home safe. And the majority of the population never knows that there was a problem, maybe, you know? I mean, you wind up with something like Apollo 13 where it's kind of hard to miss that there's a problem, but they brought everybody
yes.
home. And nobody knew the efforts that it took until they went and made a movie about it, you know?
And then the movie, as good as that movie was, we all knew what the ending was going to be, but as good as that movie was, it lacked the human element of real life nail biting, for lack of a better word.
You want to know something?
I was working
as a shuttle flight controller when that movie came out. And I went to see it in the theater. And aside from the fact that some of the guys that worked that mission as young men were still in the program, and I knew them.
Right.
It created a sense of reality for me. I came away from the movie theater with a migraine because I had been holding my breath through substantial portions of that film.
Because you had been there.
Because I had been. And they recreated really effectively what it felt like to sit console through a nail biter like that. And I have been on console for some nail biters.
When do you have any fingernails left?
Well, these days I actually go and have gel extensions put on because otherwise I don't have much fingernails left. No, seriously, my nails at this point, they break off and bleed and stuff. So it's like, no.
Gotta fix that.
Yeah, let's go have somebody take care of these. But, yeah, so it really, I know that in many respects it may have come across as very clinical and very sterilized, but that's the way we work.
You don't have time for the drama. You've got to be succinct and short and to the point. Let's get it done and get them home safe.
Yeah, you don't have time, and you don't have the energy to waste in having a hissy fit over, oh, my gosh, they're going to die, they're going to die. No, forget that. Just cut to the chase, get to work, figure out what the problem is, figure out how to fix it, get it up to them, let's get it done.
And get them home.
That's right. And that's the
you
way it
fall
works.
Apart later.
Yeah.
But in that
and
moment
sometimes
in time.
We did. I remember my first mission. I came off console for my last shift. They were getting ready to land. And I walked outside the building and it hit me. I had just worked my very first shuttle mission. I had finally achieved what that little girl sitting in front of the television had set out to do. And I stopped dead on the sidewalk, and I let out the biggest whoop of joy you can imagine. And then I got in my car, and I drove to my office. I'd just come off a 13-hour shift, night shift no less. It's morning, and I drive into work. I'm ready to go for the next one.
Got that adrenaline going now.
My boss is like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I'm here to work. Go home and get some sleep. So I did. It took me a little while to get sleep, but I did.
I tell you what, Stephanie, you are to be commended because even as a child, and this is what we talk about on this show, is someone's passion. Even as a child, you understood your passion, and you focused your entire education around fulfilling that dream.
Yes, I did. And yes, there were naysayers, not among my family, or at least not among my immediate family. But, yes, I had teachers and advisors and stuff that were like, no, you won't be able to do this. And I'm like, watch me. In high school, the guidance counselors, they gave me these aptitude tests, and they came back and said, this girl is really good in science. So they said, you should be a nurse. I grew up in a rural community, okay, out in the country, so it was, they had no clue from rocket science, okay, they just didn't. And I was like, no, I'm not even be a doctor, be a nurse, because I was female. And I'm like, no, I want to go into astronomy and space. And they were perfectly willing to helping me get a scholarship to go to nursing school. But not for rocket science. I was on my they just threw up their hands and said, well, you know, go fail. And so I managed to scrounge around, and I got myself two scholarships. And one of them, I had to do office work in the physics department. And for the other one, I was I wound up, by the time I graduated, I was the senior lab assistant for the physics department. And, you know, I went and I did it, and I did the work, and I don't have student loans to pay off. I scrounged around, and I got what I needed to get to be able to pay for my schooling. And in retrospect, I probably would have made it easier on my parents if I'd gone and found myself a job. I did not. I focused on the schooling. And so I got the equivalent of three a bachelor's degrees and an undergraduate minor in 5 years.
Wow.
And then went to graduate school.
See, ladies and gentlemen, this is what this show is about. Yes, it's called Off the Chain. Yes, we go off the chain. But those of you who have been with me know that I am a firm believer that anything that you want to do, if you want to do it bad enough, like Stephanie, you will find a way. Even with the naysayers, you will find a way, because that is the most important thing in your life. And, yeah, you may have to take a detour or two, and the dream might shift a bit, but you stand strong and make that dream come true. Am I not right, Stephanie?
Yes. Because, see, the same thing then happened as I was getting ready to graduate from undergraduate school, because my undergraduate advisor viewed me as a dreamer. He didn't think I'd ever make it. He certainly didn't think I'd ever make it in graduate school. And so I had to go out and determine what school I wanted to attend in graduate school and scrounge up my own graduate assistantship, which I did. I was a teaching assistant.
That's important.
So in the astronomy subsection of the physics department. And, you know, I made it through, and I got this step done, look to the next one, look to the next one, look to the next one. And I just kept plugging. And so I did it. And was it easy? No. Was I necessarily good at everything I tried? No. But
you didn't fail. And the reason you didn't fail is because you tried it. You succeeded.
And I kept trying as often as it took to succeed. And if I needed help, if I needed somebody to sit down with me and explain, because I was taking a physics course that I hadn't had the prerequisite math courses for yet, I did. And, yes, that did happen.
I believe it.
The physics department and the math department were not synced up. So, yes, that did happen, and I was taking physics that was more advanced than any of the math courses that I had yet had. So that got complicated in a hurry.
but yes, I did.
So.
Well, let's, as with fulfilling that dream, which I so admire it, I can't tell you how much I admire that. Let's talk about, in the time we got left, because you are going to come back in January, let's talk about your books.
Okay.
And when you retired from all of your exciting adventures, you wrote books.
Yes. I actually started writing the books way before I retired. I was writing my first book, Burnout, while I was still working in the shuttle program. It just took a long time to write because I was writing about a shuttle disaster.
Right.
And so I would, it was emotionally draining, and so I'd write a little bit, and then I'd put it away for a while and kind of get some emotional perspective built back, and then I'd pull it out and write a little bit more, and eventually it got done.
That is a powerful, powerful book, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to tell you, if you haven't read Burnout by Stephanie Osborne, you get that book because it will leave you breathless.
Well, the thing that got me so much about it was I tend to blend science fiction and mystery genres together. And of the science fiction I write, it tends to be hard science fiction, because scientist. And I do a lot of research for my books. And so when I was writing Burnout, I got my hands on the accident investigation board report for the Challenger, the disaster. That's the one that blew up right after launch. And
right.
That actually occurred. I had just gotten a job here in Huntsville as a project resident astronomer with the possibility of going up with a prototype of the instrument on board the shuttle. When I hadn't been there 2 months yet when the Challenger disaster occurred. And so the prototype development phase of my project got canceled, so I never did get to go up. But so, it basically that occurred at the beginning of my career, if you will. And so I worked my entire career, and I was starting to get finished with, well, I had actually finished the rough draft of Burnout and had given it into the hands of my writing mentor, Travis Taylor. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's had several shows on TV. You may remember Rocket City Rednecks on the National Geographic Channel, that guy. So he actually had it in hand reading it when the Columbia disaster occurred.
Oh my goodness.
The Columbia was the one that broke up during reentry. Columbia was the bird I worked with the most, and there was a friend of mine on board that mission. That was a rough time. What made it even rougher was that I had used the Challenger reports as my research. How do they reconstruct the accident? How do they determine what happened? Where do the bodies get taken for autopsies? Where is the stuff? Where are the pieces parts brought? How do they reassemble it? Where do they reassemble it? All that kind of stuff. And then I said, okay, I don't want anybody thinking that I'm trying to make a profit off of a tragedy. So I said, I'm going to make my fictional scenario be very, very different from what happened to Challenger. Instead of blowing up right after launch, I'm going to go to the opposite end of the mission, and I'm going to have my fictional scenario be a reentry breakup. And they're going to be doing this, so they're going to be in this particular inclination, which means that their approach to the Cape is going to be like this, and the overflown states are going to be these, and this is where it's going to break up, so this is where the debris field is going to be, and guess what, Yvonne?
That's what happened.
The only difference between my fictional scenario and what happened to Columbia was that my fictional scenario was sabotage, and so the debris field was longer, and it actually extended off the Texas Gulf Coast out into the Gulf of Mexico. That's the only difference. I got the same overflown states. I got the same orbital inclination. I got the same incoming trajectory to the Cape, the whole bit.
I have got chill bumps all over my body.
Tell me about it.
It was like a prophecy.
Travis had to talk me out of trashing the thing.
I'm glad you didn't.
Well, he said, no. He said, this just goes to show you that you know your stuff. This is a good story. Don't trash it. Here are my critiques. Here are the things I think you can do to make it better.
You still with me?
Huh?
I know.
Yeah.
That's difficult.
And it was just, yeah, it was hard. I had to set it aside. I could not take his input immediately and go to work on it. I couldn't.
Well, you had to process what had physically happened, knowing that you had put it on paper.
Yes.
And I'm sure on some level there was a sense of guilt.
Yes.
Because you had written.
Because no matter.
But but it wasn't you. You didn't do it. It just happened.
But no matter how logical you are, there is a part, there's a back brain thing going, and it's telling you this happened because you wrote it down.
Yeah. Or you said it out loud, or you thought it. I understand that. It's like a sixth sense. It's like being an empath, which I am, or a seer, which I've been known to do. But it just happened.
Yeah.
And that's what makes that book more powerful and more profound, is it happened, but it happened after.
Yes, I wrote it before. That entire scenario was complete and in somebody else's hands before the actual real-life accident occurred. And when I did finally go back to work on it and rewrite it and improve it according to Travis's remarks, that whole aspect of it, I had to change nothing, absolutely nothing. I thought, and I even downloaded the accident reports because I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to do this, let's do it right. Let's make sure I'm accurate. And I read through those things, and then I realized I got nothing to change. So I didn't. The other stuff in the book I improved and I worked on and I edited and I polished, but that whole aspect of it, and that's the core, that occurs in the first chapter of the book. Nothing had to change. Not one word.
Well, we're going to run out of time. Believe it or not, we're going to run out of time here very shortly. I want to talk about the Sherlock Holmes series, The Displaced Detective, because you have a great love for anything Sherlock Holmes. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Okay. Well, my first introduction to Sherlock Holmes was as a kid. Somebody gave me a copy of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Scared me witless. I was probably a little bit too young and a little bit too vivid of an imagination to have been had that particular one as an introduction. But I loved the character. I understood it. I grokked it. I became just a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. And actually, when I was in high school, I wrote a short story and submitted it to the literary magazine, and they actually threw it out. The literary teacher threw it out because she was convinced that it was plagiarized, that somebody had gone down to the library and got hold of the Conan Doyle compendium and copied a story straight out of it. Now, why on earth she didn't actually go down to the library and check, I don't know. Anyway, he stuck in my head over the years, and I went out and bought my own copy of that same compendium eventually. And then some years back, I happened to read an anthology that was a science fiction anthology, but all of the stories revolved around Sherlock Holmes. So it was Victorian era speculative fiction, Sherlock Holmes style, and I loved it. And I thought, well, I could do this. And I thought, well, yeah, but I want to do something a little bit. This has already been done. I want to do something different with it. So I thought, well, what happens if I bring him into the modern day? So then I had to sit down and figure out how I would do it and why I would do it and how to make it work from a literary standpoint. And once I had figured all those things out, suddenly the story hit me, and I sat down and I started writing. Now, Yvonne, you know, but your listeners may not, that typically for science fiction or mystery or, you know, any ordinary genre story like that, a novel runs between about 80 and 110,000 words, with the preferred word count being about 100,000 words. Well, I sat down and I started writing, and it became like trying to hold a wide-open fire hose all by myself, because I wrote 215,000 words in 2 months without stopping.
Hold on just a minute. We've got a caller. Let's see if we can. Hello, caller. This is Yvonne. May I help you?
Yes, my name is Dan L. Hollifield, and I'm the
composer. Hi, Dan. How are you? Fine. Thank you for calling in. Your music is amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I owe it all to Stephanie for writing such really wonderful books.
Well, say hello to Stephanie. She's on the other end.
Oh, yes, yes. She clued me in that she was going to be on your show tonight, so I called in.
I clued him in that his music was going to be on the show tonight.
Well, that's a side thing. Any interview that Stephanie does, I want to hear because she gives really good interviews.
Yes, she does. And when I went on her website to gather my prep for the show, I saw the music, and I had forgotten that she told me that you had written this music for the Displaced Detective series, and I downloaded it. I went on Bandcamp and downloaded the entire thing, and I'm listening to it, and the one that I put up tonight to play at the beginning of the show, I just fell in love with.
Oh, Indistinguishable from Magic. Yeah, I stole the title from Arthur C. Clarke.
Yes, it's amazing, absolutely amazing. Ladies and gentlemen, the person that I am speaking to is Dan Hollifield, and he wrote music, several tracks for Stephanie's Displaced Detective series, and they go hand in hand. Stephanie, finish telling us about Sherlock so we don't run out of time. Dan, I don't want you to go anywhere because after the show, while we still have time, after the show dies but we're still on together, I want to talk to you because I want to bring you on. Stephanie, finish telling me about Sherlock.
Well, the first story came in, like I said, rough draft at 215,000 words in just about 2 months. And by the time I was done polishing it, because, of course, the first run-through, you forget stuff, you leave stuff out, or, oh, this really needs explanation, I need to put in something here so that they know what the heck I'm talking about. And by the time it was all said and done, it wound up being about 245,000 words, which is way bigger a book than anybody is allowed to write unless they only have one name. You know, like King or Rowling,
right.
You know, somebody like that. And so I tried to cut it down, and it couldn't be cut down. And my agent tried to cut it down, and she couldn't cut it down. And my publisher tried to cut it down, and she couldn't. And the editor, and we finally decided, okay, we're just going to break it up into two volumes and tell a two-volume story because there's too much good material in here that has to be in here for the story to make sense. So that's
right.
What we did. So the case of the Displaced Detective, The Arrival, and the case of the Displaced Detective at Speed were the first two books in the series, and they came out in November and December, respectively. And as soon as I had finished writing the first story, I launched into the second one, and it did something similar, and so it just wasn't quite as big. And so the case of the cosmological killer, the Rendlesham incident, and the case of the cosmological killer endings and beginnings were books 3 and 4, and they came out the next year. And then I turned around and started in on the fifth book, and then along about the time that I was getting the fifth book done, my publisher surprised me. She said, "Steph, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I've never put out an omnibus edition." And so she collected the first four novels, and she released an ebook omnibus called The Case of the Displaced Detective Omnibus. And then I turned in book 5, which was A Case of Spontaneous Combustion. And I promised my readers two-volume stories is as many as I'm going to do in this series, I promise. So now we're getting ready for book 6 in the series to be released, and that one is called Fear in the French Quarter. And the idea came to me a couple years back when I was invited to a science fiction convention in New Orleans, and I had known that I wanted to do kind of a Hound of the Baskervilles sort of a story. And I wanted it to be like, at least at first glance, it's a haunting ghost story kind of a thing. And I had originally intended to try to set it in a castle over in Europe someplace. And so I'm wandering through the French Quarter, and I'm like, why the heck am I even thinking about putting it in Europe? This is the most haunted city in the world. This is the perfect location for it. And as I'm walking through on a Saturday night down Bourbon Street, actually I was walking down through Jackson Square, and it suddenly hit me, and the only way I know how to explain it is it was like suddenly I was aware of another reality.
Wow.
And in that reality, Sherlock Holmes and Skye Chadwick Holmes, Skye Chadwick is the scientist who brings Holmes to the modern day using something called Project Tesseract to yank him from an alternate universe's Victorian era. And she turns out to be his parallel. She is, for her universe, she was the Sherlock Holmes of her universe. So they wind up in a relationship. You're either good with that or you're not, and I don't really care. Because the characters told me what they were going to do, and they didn't give me any input into it. So
they do.
As all the best characters do.
Absolutely. Mine won't shut up.
So you know what I'm talking about. But
yes.
So anyway, so Sherlock and Skye are also walking through their universes, Jackson Square, at the same time I'm walking through it with my husband. And so I suddenly become aware of the incidents that are happening to them. And the whole way, we walk all the way down to Bourbon Street and up Bourbon Street to a restaurant, and we eat, and they're mirroring us. And I'm aware, okay, he just got approached by a hooker, and she just got solicited, and oh my gosh, that he's pissed. And you know, and I couldn't wait to get back to the hotel and write it down.
I understand that, don't you, Dan?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing about Stephanie's stuff. She writes the absolute most interesting characters, and they come to life as you read the books.
Yes, they
do. It's just absolutely fabulous. That's the thing that inspired me to do the music. She had already had the first four books out, and I'd been reading them over her shoulder and doing reviews on Amazon and different websites and things. And I sat down with this music program that I've got, and something just came together, and I go, Stephanie needs to hear this. And I sent her this one piece of music, and she goes, do you know what you just did? My father doesn't like music, and he listened to this, and he thinks it's fantastic. Can you do more? And I go, well, yeah, I suppose I could. She goes, can you do a whole album? And I go, yeah, I suppose I could. And I sat down and got to work on it, and we got Daryl, Stephanie's husband, to do the cover art for it, and it just kind of blew up. And there all this stuff is, and it's all her work. It's all her work. All I did was... provide like a soundtrack to the books.
Exactly.
As if they were movies.
That's what it is. And that's the cool thing about it. It's when I write, and my writing style has been described as very cinematic. And it's the truth, because what I'm doing is I'm seeing it happen in my head and writing it down. It's like watching a movie in my mind. And what happened was when Dan started making the music, he was creating the score for the movie in my head.
Yep.
And
it's amazing.
Well, thank you. But, you know, Stephanie deserves all the credit. All I did was get inspired.
Well, thank you. But, I mean, hey, you know, I can pass the credit on back to this guy named Doyle, so that's all right.
It just keeps on rolling. Well, now, you've got another book. Fear in the Fear in the French Quarter is out now, right?
It is starting to ship now. Yes, it's been available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes Noble, and my publisher noticed yesterday that Amazon is starting to ship the fulfillments. So if you pre-order from Amazon, you can probably expect sometime in the next week or so to start getting your books in. The official release date isn't until October 5th. I am having a release party the weekend before at that same science fiction convention in New Orleans. And I will have another one here in Huntsville a couple weeks after that. So, I'm having a blast with it. It's so much fun.
And you're going to put up your release parties, right, so that people that are in those areas, because you do know that once this show is done and it goes into archives, it automatically goes to iTunes. It automatically goes to Stitcher, which is heard on Sirius Radio. And then I upload it to SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Podcast.com, Podomatic, and Spreaker. And when I upload it to Spreaker, it goes to YouTube, and it also goes to TuneIn Radio.
The release party in New Orleans will be on Saturday. Let me take a look at the calendar real quick here so I get the dates right. Saturday, October 1st, that evening, at the Contra Flow Science Fiction Convention, which will be held at the, I can't think of what the hotel's name is, but it's the hotel at the airport in New Orleans. And then 2 weeks later on, I believe it's the 15th of October, which is again a Saturday, here in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Sheraton Four Points, also at the Huntsville Airport, at Constellation Science Fiction Convention. So those are my two release parties. If you're in the area, come on by, folks.
Well, since we're getting short, and again, we're bringing you back, quickly tell the folks where you can be reached.
You can find me at my website, www.stephanie-osborne.com. You can find me on Amazon. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Writer Steph. I'm pretty easy to find. You don't have to look far.
Please, if you've got a minute, tell them about the Gentleman as Geas series as well.
Oh, okay. Yes, I had a publisher who is a fan of the Displaced Detective series, and he contacted me and said, Steph, I want you to do something Sherlockian for me, but I want you to do it traditional Sherlockian, traditional Victorian. So we talked, and so the Gentleman Aegis series was born. And Gentleman Aegis is the prequel series to the Displaced Detective. It's my version of Holmes in his original space-time continuum, Victorian era, with Watson, as young men just getting started. The first book,
wow,
Sherlock Holmes and the Mummy's Curse, came out last November. It just won a Silver Falchion Award from the Killer Nashville Mystery Conference. I'm really thrilled about that. And so, I'm now an award-winning author. So there.
The book is absolutely fantastic. I can tell you, as somebody who reviewed it, it's amazing. It's every bit as good as the original Displaced Detective stuff. And it's like, oh, give me more, and she did.
Wow. Now,
yes.
What I would like for you to do, Stephanie, we have about 4 minutes left, and about a minute and a half. What advice do you have for people that are just starting out that have a passion? How would you advise them to fulfill that passion?
To write or to go into the space program or what? I mean,
whatever their passion is. General advice to someone that has a dream.
Sit down and take stock of your dream and see if logically it can be reached. If you're looking to if you're looking to create the world's first space warp drive, that might or might not be reasonable, depending on if the science and the mathematics have really gotten us to that point yet. But if your desire is to work in the space program, you know, that is eminently attainable. So sit down and look at your dreams and try to determine, can they logically be reached? And if so, what do I need to do to get there? And once you've determined, well, I may not be able to be the first colonist to Alpha Centauri, but I can definitely work in the space program, and I can probably help work on the advanced drive systems. Okay, fine. Now you know what you need to do. Now you know what your degrees need to be in. You know what courses you need to study. And once you know that, then go do it. Don't let anybody tell you you cannot. In fact, if they tell you you can't do it, you turn to them and you say, watch me.
Exactly.
And then go do it.
And then go do it. Lady, and the reason we do this, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of every show, I ask my guests to give advice, because everybody's got a dream. And those of you that have been with me since the inception of this show know that this was on my bucket list. This was a 5-year dream. I am fulfilling that dream. It took 5 years. My publishing took 40 years. Anything you want to do in this world, if it's garbage collector, if it's concert violinist, if it's author, if it's musician, if it's being a mother, if it's being a father, whatever your dream is, you and you alone have the ability to make that dream come true. You have to ask yourself, how important is it to me? How bad do I want it? Am I willing to make my complete focus on my dream? If the answer to that is yes, then go for it.
You know, I don't know about you guys, but I've heard many people tell me, oh, you know, I want to be a writer, but.
Yep. There's no but. If you want it, you do it.
Yeah, there's no but.
There is no try. Either do or do not.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yoda speaks. But at the end of your days, ladies and gentlemen, when you're laying there and you're getting ready to meet your maker, I don't want you to say, I shoulda, I woulda, I coulda. Because that speaks failure. Because as Dan said, try or do not. Do or do not, there is no try.
Thank you, Jordan.
Exactly. Tomorrow night.
Yeah, you either put your whole heart into something or you do something else.
Or don't do anything. But then don't blame the world because you don't succeed. Tomorrow night, my guest is Hydra M. Starr. She is a woman of extraordinary talent. She is an erotica horror author, and she is just one of them. You don't want to miss this show. And, Stephanie, I want to thank you, my beautiful friend. You will be back on my show on January the 4th, so ladies and gentlemen, put it on your calendars. We're bringing Stephanie back because 1 hour is not enough. We'll probably do a 2-hour show the next time because she'll have more. Dan, I want to get you on my show so when the show itself, you guys don't hang up because we can still talk. It will show up in archives, but that's okay. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. Thank you for taking time out. And until I see you again, remember, do or do not. There is no try. And if there is no try, you have failed. If you try, you have succeeded.
Amen.
Never blame anyone because you didn't achieve your dreams, because no one can steal them without your permission. You and you alone are responsible your life. And with that, I say, until tomorrow evening, good night. Okay. They can hear, they'll be able to hear this conversation in archives, but we're not live on the air. Stephanie, thank you so much for being on the show tonight, honey.
Well, thank
I appreciate it. And we just barely tipped the edge of what we were going to talk about. Dan, I want to get you on the show. So after we hang up, friend me on Facebook. And because what I want to do is I want to bring you on the show, and I want to play your music, and then us talk about it on the show. And
well, there's a lot more music than just the Displaced Detective stuff, but that's not important.
But that was the first put out.
Yeah, that was and I want to bring I want to get more of your music, not just the Displaced Detective, but the rest that's out there. And Stephanie also says you're an author, right?
Oh yeah. Well, actually, Stephanie and I are co-writing the fourth book in the Chris Berrien saga.
This is true.
Because she is so swamped with doing the Displaced Detective and the Gentleman of Gia stuff that she needed somebody to do the donkey work. And
That's the best way
to say it, really. I'm trying to follow your outlines and do the best job I can, even though it's not my series, and I did misunderstand the scale of some of the stuff that was involved. And I wrote too small. I wrote too small. I made it too intimate. And
Is that the Chris Berrien saga is a shared universe. It started off with Travis Taylor and another author named Daryl Bain, and they wrote the first book in the series called Human by Choice.
Uh-huh.
And Human by Choice did really, really well. It was a really cool idea. And so Daryl Bain started on the second book in the series along about the time that Travis's wife got pregnant with their second child. And Travis up to his eyeballs, and so he had to step out. And so by that point in time, Burnout was in the pipeline to be published, and so the publisher was the same publisher, so she tapped me to step into Travis's shoes on the second book in the series, which became The Y Factor. Then Mr. Bain is on up in years, and so he started backing out by the time the third book rolled around. And so I took the lead on the third book, which was the Chris Berrien Alliance. And now I need to close out the story arc. And I had the idea for a book called Heritage, but I was being so swamped by Displaced Detective and Gentleman Aegis and, you know, all these other different things that I had to get out. And since it wasn't, quote-unquote, my universe, you know, the concept wasn't mine, it was proving a little bit harder to write than the others were. And so I decided I needed help. And so Dan had just gotten published his first novel, which is really an anthology. Dan, you can tell her the name of the book.
Tales from the Marinebrium. And the Marinebrium is a spaceport bar. Basically, the whole thing is a bunch of short stories of different people sitting around in this bar on an alien planet telling tall tales to one another. And the people listening never know if it's just something that somebody made up or if it's something that actually happened to them or if it's just some absolutely grandiose legend from a past they wish they had lived, and it's kind of funny and some of it's kind of serious and some of it is just absolutely just adventure and really wild things, and it sprang from a shared universe that I accidentally began 20 years ago with the first two short stories in the series that I wrote. And the fellow who was publishing it online at the time asked to guest write a third story in the series, and all of a sudden my stuff became a shared universe. And
wow.
Now there are over 100 stories in the shared universe. And I had, before the book came out, I had about half a dozen. When the book came out, I had about 18, because I wrote some brand new stuff for the book, and I rewrote all of my old stuff so that all the ideas that I couldn't fit in back then, because I was just a 30-year-old guy starting out trying to fine-tune and learn how to be a decent writer. And stuff just kind of exploded for a while. At one time, there were like 2 million readers of the online stuff. But it's been a long, long time, and that didn't translate into sales of the book, unfortunately.
Well, no, when it's free, you know, it's you get free milk from the cow, you don't buy the cow.
Yeah, and then now that it's $3, nobody wants to pay for it.
Well, it bears marketing. That's why we do this show, to market, to get you out there so people know you're there and that it is in print and you can download it, and it's a wonderful read. Right, Steph?
Yes, it is. I mean,
well, there's one story in there that Stephanie is not allowed to read.
Uh-oh.
Stephanie is not allowed to read because it's a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yes.
Ah.
And I went back and I read every Conan Doyle story in existence and every pastiche I could lay my hands on. And then I sat down and started typing. And I came up with this thing that fit into my Spaceport Bar universe, featuring my Spaceport Bar characters plus Holmes and Watson. And it's set in 1925, and they run across somebody that seems to be trying to forge artworks in the British Museum. And they have two suspects, one of which is the client who hired Sherlock Holmes.
Okay, as soon as I get off of here, I'm going to go download all your stories. Now, also, what y'all don't know, Stephanie might know, but what you may not know, is I don't post my reviews on Amazon. I have a podcast that I do. It's on podcastgarden.com. And I have almost 500 hits, well, actually more than that now, on all of the reviews that I've already done. And once I post it, I make it downloadable so that the author that I've done the review for, the musician I've done the review for, can download it and put it on their website or repost it anywhere they want to, so that someone hears a verbal review rather than reading it, because, as you know, things get lost in translation when one reads. But by doing a verbal review on a 3-minute podcast, people are eating this up.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes,
so what I'm gonna do, Stephanie, I'm gonna go back and I'm gonna put Burnout on that podcast,
okay.
And then I'm gonna put The Displaced Detective on that podcast. I didn't think about it until just now, because that will also get you more response, and you too, Dan, once I read yours, and especially since we're doing these shows.
That's great. Thank you.
My my pleasure, just paying it forward. But we're going to have to end this now because they're going to be cutting me off here in a minute. But all this is going to, we'll go into the archive shows once I hang up and we hang up this, and this goes up into archives. This entire conversation will be heard by anybody that listens to it. But the live show, people that listen to it live, unless they listen to it in podcast, they miss a little intakes or outtakes or whatever they want to call it. But thank
you
guys.
I tell you, you asked me to friend you on Facebook. It'd probably be quicker if you look me up and sent me a friend request.
I'll do that as soon as I get off of here.
Okay, and I'll respond just as quickly as I see it.
I'll go to Stephanie's page and find you and friend you, and then we can either do a 2-hour show with both of you, or I can do separate shows. Y'all tell me what you guys want to do, because y'all are intertwined in all of this.
Well,
sort of.
Let's talk about it and figure out what's going to work best.
Yeah, really. I mean, Stephanie's a whole lot more interesting than I am. I mean, I don't see anybody wanting to listen to me talk for 2 hours.
Dan, Stephanie will tell you I can pull things out of people they didn't know they had in them.
Yep. Listen to her.
I'm just this guy, you know.
Yeah, well, you got some, yeah. Okay, he just threw the gauntlet down, didn't he, Stephanie?
Uh-huh.
I'm just this guy, my hind foot. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she said, "Watch me."
Yeah. Don't believe me. And Dan, you don't know this about me. Not only do I have a degree in criminal justice and I write true crime, but I'm also a hunter, as in bounty hunter.
We have a lot in common.
See? I rest my case, Your Honor.
All right. I tell you what. Y'all do one and we'll do one, and that way they don't have to be tied.
Okay.
Yeah,
we can
Stephanie's readers deserve to listen to her talk about her stuff without me interrupting every few minutes with a bad joke, which I'm prone to do.
But what we're also doing is, Dan, you have readers too, and you make too little of yourself, and it's time
we're going to fix that. We're going to fix that.
Yep.
There's no self-doubt on this train.
I'm world famous on the internet, but not much in any place else. So.
Well, guess what? We're going to fix it. But, children, I'm going to end this conversation, Dan. I'm going to go friend you and we'll hook up and set up a date to get you on the air. Stephanie, I have you down for January the 4th, and we'll either do an hour and a half or 2-hour show. I think we can do a 2-hour show because there was a lot we didn't get to.
I know.
And you'll have more out by then, too.
Hmm?
You'll have more stories out by then, too.
I will, yes. The anthology should be out. Hopefully we'll be looking at bringing out the first book or two of the new series that I'm working on called Division One, and some more stuff like that.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about that. We didn't talk about your husband's illustrations. We didn't talk about your passion. So we'll bring all that in January.
I kind of think my passion kind of came out anyway, so that's all right.
Yeah, and I did mention Daryl's illustrations.
Yes,
well,
you did.
But yes, you did. You are the man, Dan. All right.
Well,
I
try.
You did good. I will talk to y'all later, and Dan, as soon as I get off from here, I'll go friend you.
Okay, I'll be looking for it.
All right, thanks again, both of you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.